When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Aaron Camaro and Chris Sinzak.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Decibel Geek Podcast. I'm Chris Sinzak, along here with Aaron Camaro, my co-host.
I'm excited.
Are you?
I'm really excited.
Your nipples are hard.
Really hard.
So today we've got a great guest today, someone that me and Aaron both look up to quite a bit.
Big time.
And you'll hear our brown nosing during the interview, I'm sure. But we don't care.
It's well deserved.
We are we're interviewing That Metal Show host Eddie Trunk.
Love that guy.
Who is mostly well known for That Metal Show, but also known very well for his Friday Night Rock Show and also Saturday Night Rock Show in the New York area. We didn't just want to talk about That Metal Show and the stuff that he's got going on now. We wanted to go back in time when he was paying some dues and to give you an idea of where he came from. Because a lot of people just say, oh, it's just the guy from the VH1 show.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize how much, you know, as far as, you know, helping metal get a good name and showing the good side of heavy metal and hard rock instead of making us all look like grease bag, you know, long-haired rock and roll derelicts, you know, that there's actually some good, you know, quality, you know, proponents to hard rock and heavy metal. And, you know, just to, you know, fly the flag and fly it high, you know, and amen to that. And Eddie Trunk is awesome for doing that. He's done a lot for us.
Yeah, and you're going to hear a lot of stuff about his history and some great things that he's done over the years and some cool experiences he's had with other rock stars. We're also going to get into a meeting that the first time he met Peter Criss when he was just a kid. He was basically like 19 years old, just starting out in radio, and you'll hear his memories of that, and you know memories of his time with Ace, and we went pretty heavy into this thing with Ace.
I'm excited. Let's get to it. Yeah. I can't wait no more.
To most hard rock and heavy metal fans, Eddie Trunk needs no introduction. But for our listeners that inhabit the underside of a rock, we'll do it anyway. Growing up in New Jersey in the 1970s and early 1980s, Eddie Trunk fell in love with rock and roll with his discovery of the Raspberries, which led into a full-on love affair with such bands as Kiss, Black Sabbath, and UFO, among others. After a stint writing record reviews for his high school paper, Eddie was introduced to the world of radio when a local college station started a summer program that would teach students the basics of how to work in the industry. While the program was short-lived, it was enough to pique Eddie's interest in a future in radio. While working a job at a local record store after high school, Trunk would recommend bands to the radio station employees from across the street. Still feeling the urge from the summer program, he put together a demo tape through a friend's pirate radio station and submitted it. The tape netted him an internship and later his own show. A career in radio was born. In 1985, Trunk's life changed again when he met John Zazula, a record store owner who was starting his own label with a couple of unknown bands named Metallica and Anthrax. Trunk would be instrumental in getting these bands radio exposure and wound up joining Johnny Z at Megaforce Records, becoming the label's vice president at only 25 years of age. While at Megaforce, Eddie was instrumental in bringing former Kiss guitarist Ace Frehley back into the music world with the formation of Frehley's Comet. Other bands on the label's roster included Raven, Manowar, Overkill, and King's X. After a stint in music management, Trunk continued building his radio resume with gigs at stations in the New York area, playing and interviewing many legendary rock and metal artists. From 2001 to 2005, Eddie was the featured male host for VH1 Classic, interviewing music luminaries for various specials as well as the popular Hangin' With series. Among the many in television satellite radio ventures over the past 10 years, most of the world has come to know Eddie Trunk from his hosting duties on VH1's That Metal Show, considered the premier talk show for all things hard rock and heavy metal. With the release of his new book, Eddie Trunk's Essential Hard Rock and Heavy Metal, and the popularity of That Metal Show, there seems to be plenty on the horizon for Eddie Trunk. This is our conversation. Enjoy.
I'd like to go back in time when, you know, before this, because you have, going through your bio, you have quite an interesting history. I wanted to get your thoughts on it, because I read on your bio about how you were introduced to radio through this program that a college brought to your high school. and then you wound up getting a job at the record store across from DHA in New Jersey, and making tapes at a pirate radio station to turn into them.
Yeah. Here's a guy who's worked for everything he's got, you know, no doubt about that.
It's a fascinating start. When you got that that job at the record store across from the station, were you aiming to get a job in radio at that point?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the radio station was literally across the street, and the owners would come in a lot of times and buy albums and talk to us about music. And they would also, you know, people forget, but, you know, I mean, CDs were brand new at the time, a few years after that. And, you know, just the idea of having a CD was such a big deal, having an album on CD. So a lot of times they'd come in whenever an album would be released on CD and want to buy it, because the owner at the time of that radio station was very into the technology and emerging technologies, which CDs were at the time. Mm-hmm. So he was all about, you know, coming in and learning what the newest stuff was and what he could buy for his station. So, you know, I would always angle and beat him up to say, hey, man, you know, you've got to let me come over there. There's a lot of music that we're selling here that you're missing.
Yeah.
And you're not playing for people. And, you know, he was somewhat receptive to it. But, of course, you know, at that point I was 17, 18-year-old kid. And, you know, he just chalked it up as me wanting to hear some of my favorite bands on the radio.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I needed to find a way to, because since I really had, you know, no radio experience beyond a quick second while I was in high school, I had to find a way to show him that I could do it. And that's when the owner of the record store revealed to me that he had a pirate radio station in his basement. And
nice.
I was like, I didn't even really know what that meant. Mm-hmm. And one night I went over there and he pulled up a sheet, and underneath was a little console and a microphone and a transmitter. It was somewhere in his backyard. And
nice.
He said, you know, we can't do this all the time because we can get caught because it's technically illegal, but I turn this on and do some radio shows, and sometimes people stumble across the signal and hear it. And I'm like, you're kidding me. He's like, no. He goes, but at least you can kind of make a tape and you can do a pseudo radio show and show them what you would sound like.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, sure. So I did that a couple times, and we edited up this really professional sounding tape that was, you know, much better than I actually was on the air, because we just did it to, you know, I did a lot of smoke and mirrors with the equipment, doing it over and over again just to get it to a point where
sure.
I thought it would appeal to the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was kind of the catalyst to say, okay, you know, I think that the guy, when I submitted the tape, was pretty aware that there was, you know, it didn't come from a real radio station, but at least I think he saw the initiative and the commitment to try to do it, and figured he'd give me a shot.
Yeah, I mean,
that's how it really started.
Showed the guy how much you wanted it. You know, anybody can appreciate that. Mm-hmm. You know, you work hard.
Yeah, it was just, but, you know, I tell people all the time, and this is the real truth of it, it was very much driven by the passion of, I never got into any of this stuff that, you know, back then. It was never about even, you know, trying to make money. It was never about trying to be recognized or be known. It was just really always about the fact that as a kid I was so frustrated, this music I loved I didn't hear anywhere.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I've got, if they're not going to play it, you know, let me play it. Let me find a way to introduce this stuff and share it with other people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was always about, and it's really still about today. The big difference is I'm not a kid anymore, and I've got a family and I need to support, and obviously it is my career now, and it is how I make a living. So the financial end of it is obviously important, because you know, I need to support a family and survive. It's what I do for a living. Back then, though, you know, and it's still driven, it's still driven by the fact that I love these bands and I love what I'm doing, but
right.
it has obviously become a job and a career at this point. But back then it was just purely about, you're not going to pay me, I don't care. I just want to come up there and be able to play these records for people. And quite honestly, I mean, to prove that point, I actually did not get paid. I worked at that radio station for 2 years before I got paid a cent.
Yeah.
I was just kind of a glorified intern, if you will, where I would just, you know, wasn't really going to any school, but I would just come up there and, you know, be kind of like the station gopher, and every once in a while get a chance to crack the mic and go on the air.
Well,
so that's really how it was, and I never actually got on their books. I was pretty well known personality at the radio station for about 2 years without even working there, technically. And right. then finally they said, okay, well, you know, we'll give you a shift and let you do this show that you want to do.
Yeah. And that's you, awesome. And yeah, it mentions how you had pushed for a rock and metal specific show on the station. And, how big of a pushback did you get on that when you approached them with that?
Pretty significant for a while. That was before I was actually in the door with it. What had happened was, you know, they were just, you know, they didn't know what was going on. And I tell people this all the time. It's kind of hard to understand this now, but this is about 1983. Mm-hmm. It's a long time ago. And this genre of music, you know, heavy metal in general, was very much an emerging thing back then.
Right.
It was not looked upon. It was not the established sort of niche genre of music. So back then, you know, Metallica had just released Kill 'Em All, mm-hmm. and people just for the first time heard really what, you know, really heard thrash. And then at the same time, you had bands like Quiet Riot releasing Metal Health. You had Def Leppard starting to really break with Pyromania just coming out. So you have to put it into context. Those albums now are almost considered mainstream. And are mainstream to a degree, especially, you know, Def Leppard,
like, classic, yeah, classic records nowadays.
But back then, those bands were not anything close to the name they are now, mm-hmm. and they were very much new bands trying to get airplay before those albums broke, mm-hmm. and they were very much considered heavy metal records that these radio stations didn't know what to do with. So, for me, I would just tell them, hey, you know, you've got to be playing these records because we're having a lot of people come in and buy them, and you're not playing them. And they would kind of follow that trend, and they'd realize that I'd be saying this stuff all the time. And sure enough, you know, they'd start to see these albums start to pop up on sales charts and stuff, and they put two and two together and like, hey, you know, maybe this kid is on to something. So that's when they finally caved in and said, okay, you know, come on up and do – you know, go ahead and do your thing, and we'll see what happens. And the other thing, because, listen, radio is a business and all that, the other thing that was really important was that the record store I worked for at the time told the radio station they would sponsor the show. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, radio is big business, and if you have a sponsor, especially for a smaller local station like DHA was, that's going to underwrite the show in the sense that, you know, they're going to buy advertising in every show and be the name sponsor.
Yeah.
It was really a good package for them. They really couldn't lose. But one of the things that a lot of people don't know that was really frustrating for me back then was I had the concept. I got the show on the air. I did it myself for a couple weeks. And then I was replaced, and I actually became a behind-the-scenes guy on the show, only kind of cracking the mic and giving some news reports, because they had a woman there that really didn't know anything about the music or care about the music, but she was a DJ who was a part-time DJ, and she wanted more hours and more work. And she made a huge stink when this unknown kid came in and started doing a three-hour, four-hour shift. And all she looked at it as, somebody's on the air and got a shift over me, and I've been here for however long.
Right. The whole seniority thing.
No recognition of what was even going on.
Her to say, okay, well, she's going to kind of host the show, and you just tell her what to play and say. Mm. And that went on for a long time, actually, and it was very, very frustrating.
Yeah, that stinks.
I'd sit there behind the scenes, and I'd have to bite my tongue, and I'd have to listen to her kind of mispronounce the names of bands and stumble through stuff. And it just, you know, I really had to kind of, you know, pay my dues in that respect then a whole other time.
So that went on about 2 years?
Yeah, that went on for a while, actually, and then I got frustrated, and I kind of walked away from it, and I said, you know, I'm not going to do this unless I'm out front on it, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. I couldn't understand where she was coming from, but I was kind of like, you know, I've got to do other things then. You know, I can't keep operating like this.
And, right. You know, it's tough to have
feel good about it.
Have,
you know,
a vision,
so I got to a point where I would just record a weekly 5-minute segment of music news, mm-hmm. which I called Metal News, and that was it. And then until I actually got the show back, which was a number of years, there was a point where that's all I had to do with it. But the desire to do radio was always there. I knew one day it would come back to me mm-hmm. because I knew she was just doing it for, you know, for a radio gig. She wasn't doing it for the passion of any love of that music, and I knew eventually that would, you know, come around.
Well, and one thing that a lot of people definitely know about you is your love of Kiss, which we definitely share that love. And for I don't know if you know about this, but for the last couple of years, every now and then these pictures pop up on Kiss message boards. These pictures of Peter Criss doing a show at a place called the Cherry Croft in Newton, New Jersey in 1984. And you are in these, in a couple of these pictures. Do you remember, you remember this show?
I do very well.
Was that your first meeting with Peter?
Yeah. That's when I was working at DHA too. And, Peter was recently out of the band at the time. And he had, he was the other guy. Depending upon what pictures you're looking at, because I know who's putting those pictures up. It's actually a good friend of mine.
Oh, okay.
He had those shots and he was posting them on Facebook and stuff. Mm-hmm. So they started to circulate. I actually tweeted one out the other day because I just found one and I got a kick out of it. But depending upon which shot it is, there's certain pictures that are just me and Peter and a few friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a couple shots that also have Stan Penridge in them. And Stan, you know, was the guy who co-wrote Beth and was a good friend of Peter's back then. I think he's since passed away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this was just a few years after Peter left Kiss, and we had found out, I think Stan lived in New Jersey, and we had found out that this little bar and tavern place in New Jersey was going to have a jam that Stan Penridge was going to play. And that that word got out that Peter Criss was going to play drums.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, you know, we're kids at that point and huge Kiss fans, and nobody really knew what Peter was up to. It was, you know, 3-4 years after he was out of the band, and we're like, you got to be kidding me. you know, nobody really knew about this thing. So we all got in our car, and we kind of kept it quiet because we figured if we told a lot of people, I mean, it was literally a little restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, you know, this is going to get, you know, it's going to get out of hand and Peter doesn't show or whatever. So we all, you know, just me and three or four friends got in the car and went up there. And sure enough, you know, we walk in and people having a drink at the bar or whatever, having dinner. And there in the corner is Peter and Stan doing a set.
That's a surreal idea.
It was completely crazy. And what was really crazy, too, is the few people that were in there actually didn't even know who it was, Peter Criss.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it was just completely anonymous. It could have just been any duo doing a set.
Right.
So that's amazing.
You know, we went up to him and during the breaks and we started talking. And if anybody has ever met Peter, he's, you know, he's really a fun guy to talk to. And he's really got a great sense of humor and loves to chat and loves to connect when he's in the right mood with, you know, and he was that night. And we had a great time and we hung out there that whole night. You know, we yell out requests and he'd play them and goof around and we'd have some, you know, some drinks with him during breaks. And then we took those pictures that you saw and it was really a pretty memorable night. And then what happened was afterwards, Peter ended up coming to, I told Peter that at that point I had just started working at this radio station in New Jersey and he said he was going to be around for the next couple days. So I said, well, you know, if we can get it approved, I'd love for you to come up and do an interview. Because, again, nobody had heard from him. He'd laid very low since Kiss went away for him. And I went into the radio station, and I told one of the DJs there, and she just took it upon herself, because I didn't have my own show at that point, but she took it upon herself to ask Peter to come to and walk in on her show.
Mm-hmm.
And she really didn't clear it in advance with the program director, but Peter showed up the next day. I'll never forget, he came in with his wife, who at the time was Deborah, I think.
Yeah.
Who was the swimsuit girl, the cover, the...
Coppertone
girl. And they had their kid, which I guess would be Peter's oldest daughter, who at the time was, you know, a baby. And they just showed up, and Peter went in and did this interview, which was fine, but they didn't get it cleared, and the radio station owner went kind of nuts about it. And the one thing I'll never forget, and I tell Peter this all the time, is that I remember that his daughter was crawling at this point, literally through the radio station. And we had these boxes of stuff that had come in with all those little styrofoam packing things.
Yeah.
And she had gotten into them, and they were strewn all over the hallway and throughout the lobby, which made the owner even mad. But it's just so funny, of all the stupid little things that you remember about something from back then. That's the one thing I remember. And, of course, now I think she's a married woman with kids of her own, which is, you know, shows how much time has passed.
Absolutely.
But it was a really memorable night, and I'm glad my friend took those pictures because I got a kick out of seeing them again.
Yeah, it's definitely cool. It's definitely a snapshot of a moment.
Rubbing our last two brain cells together. This is a Decibel Geek Podcast.
Oh! Oh, yes!
Proud to be one of David Lee Roth's favorite podcasts.
Yeah, yeah!
He's always running to get the next episode.
Oh, God! Oh, God, I'm running! Oh, yeah!
He wouldn't lie to you.
God damn it, baby! No, I ain't lying to you! I'm only gonna tell you one time! Oh, yeah!
So, be like Diamond Dave and listen to the Decibel Geek Podcast.
Oh, yeah! Yeah, yeah, yeah! Woo! Woo!
Hi, this is Marilyn Manson, surgically removed rib, and you're listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast.
Not long after that is when you met Johnny Z at Rock and Roll Heaven, and when Megaforce got started up. Now, when you and I know you started playing stuff like Metallica and Anthrax for them. I'm thinking you were probably one of the first people to mainstream play some of this stuff at the time. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I tell a story in my book in the Metallica chapter about that exact night and exactly what happened. But yeah, I mean, I had gone to Johnny before he had Megaforce, or around the same time in the early days. He also had a flea market record store with a lot of imports and stuff, and I was a regular customer in there, and I'd go talk to him and buy a lot of imports and emerging bands from him, and then I started doing my metal show on the radio, which was really one of the first, if not the first, you know, kind of specialty metal show on commercial radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that got on his radar very quickly, so he ended up coming and, you know, kind of talking to me, and then start giving me records and saying, hey, if you could just play this, get the word out, I think this is really cool, and if I liked it, I did play it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how he and I developed the relationship really early on. And then he had this band, you know, his band Metallica, that he was trying to get any exposure for. It was such an extreme style of music that nobody would really give him a shot with it at that time.
Yeah.
So he came up to the radio station one night in the middle of the night when I was on the air and just brought this album, and he says, listen, he goes, if you can just do me a favor and just, you know, play something from this album. I remember the song was Jump in the Fire, and he said, just anything just to help get the word out about this band. I can't find anybody that'll play it. He says, I'd really appreciate it, and you know, if I can ever get this thing going and I can build a record company, you know, I'd love to have you come work for me someday. And I'm like, well, listen, you know, whatever happens with that. But I said, you know, I'll give it a shot. So I put it on the air. We played it while he was standing there, and he left the vinyl copy with me. He left. He scribbled on the vinyl copy of the album something like, I have it somewhere, something like, Eddie, you were the first, thank you, or something like that.
That's cool.
And then he left. And, I'll be honest with you, as I say in my book, I'm not going to lie and say I heard the future of music and I immediately loved it. It was, to my ears, kind of much more extreme than anything I was into at the time.
Sure.
But I thought it was worth taking a shot at, and kind of followed the band's career from there. And as the career went through the roof, Johnny made good on his word, and I ended up going to work for him a few years later.
Yeah, you ended up becoming the vice president at only 25 years old, isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, that was really, you know, but to be honest, it was easier for Johnny and Megaforce to hand out titles than it was to hand out money. So you know, instead of giving raises, he was big on increasing your title without the money to match.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, again, I'm a kid at this point. I'm right. 23, 24, whatever it is, and I'm just happy to be in the game. And mm-hmm. I was still living at home or just starting to move out or whatever, so my overhead was low. And I just, you know, I was happy to be a part of this label. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I started out doing – I mean, listen, the company at its height for me was maybe 7-8 employees total. I was really the second person he hired. He had a woman by the name of Metal Maria who was like his publicist. She was there because she was also, I think, his babysitter at one point. So that mm-hmm. it was nice. A very family operation. When I first started working for him and that company – I worked on the floor of his living room was my office. And then as the company grew and Metallica took off and went to Elektra, but he got a big payout for that. Mm-hmm. Then there was a proper office and everybody had offices. And I actually was responsible not only for helping bring in some bands, but also to actually bring in a lot of the employees. Mm-hmm. So it was a great experience. I mean, it was about 3.5 years all total. But it was a lot of fun and it brought a lot of different, you know, things into my world. It was a whole different end of the business as opposed to being the out front guy. I was a behind the scenes guy and I really enjoyed it. And I some aspects of it I miss and some aspects of it I still do to help out bands. Like, you know, I love doing A&R work and the creative stuff. So mm-hmm. I still do that. Actually for a lot of times I get, you know, called into that sort of work, not as a proper job, but just to help bands out and give some feedback and say, hey, this is good, or this production, or you should use this mix guy, or whatever.
Right on.
I really enjoyed that sort of stuff, and when some really well-known bands now that I have become close with, you know, have kind of sounded stuff off of me over the years ever since. So, obviously, the music business has changed tremendously since back then, but, you know, it was pretty cool in my mid-20s to, you know, be up there. We were distributed by Atlantic Records, so I would take meetings with Atlantic and, you know, their top executives, and it was it was really a really cool experience.
And it was during this period that that Ace comes into the picture with Fraley's Comet, and I don't know if you've seen this. Being a Kiss nerd, we trade DVDs and VHS and all this. So have you seen these home movies of that Ace took on the London trip to Hammersmith in '87?
I've not only seen them; I probably shot some of them.
You actually did, because there's some shots of. Somebody's filming the marquee out at the front of the Hammersmith, and then I can hear your voice when you go backstage going, I shot the marquee, I got all the shots of the marquee. And I was like, that's Eddie Trunk. And there's that. You're actually on one scene in the lobby when Ace comes down from his room.
Yep. I haven't watched that stuff in a long time. I have copies of it somewhere on VHS myself. I remember the trip. I remember maybe my second or third time ever going to England. And I was there working with Ace and Megaforce, which, you know, Ace was really my project for Megaforce.
I was going to ask you about that. So at this point, you know, you're still pretty much a young kid. You become an executive at Megaforce, and now does it get to the point for you? Is like, now here's my chance to help, you know, help Ace Frehley be able to put out some new music, or, you know, was it something you reached out to him for? Or is it how did that all go down?
Well, I was, as you said, you know, grew up a huge Kiss fan, and I knew that Ace was knocking around out there, and he was, again, pretty reclusive. Nobody had seen or heard from him. Most people didn't even see him without makeup. I mean, there was really mm-hmm. not a lot out there, even of him out of his costume. So I, you know, as a fan, I always had a great interest if, you know, where is Ace, or what, you know, Ace could really be doing something great now.
Right.
He still has such a fan base. But the thing that changed is that one of the things I said to Johnny when he hired me, I've always liked heavy music, but I also always liked rock and hard rock music as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I said to Johnny when he hired me is, I said, listen, you've got a lot of really heavy music here. You know, you've got Metallica, you've got Anthrax, you've got Overkill, you've got Manowar, you've got Raven, you've got all these bands. I said, it's all well and good. I said, but I'd like to see this company grow and expand and get some more, you know, hard rock type acts that maybe could actually have a shot at getting some real radio airplay and sell a ton of records. And he's like, well, what do you have in mind? And I told him, and he knew from me going in the store that I was a big Kiss fan. I said, listen, I don't know where he is or what he's doing, but I said, I know Ace Frehley's out there.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, there's obviously a ton of stories about Ace, even at this point, about drinking, drugs, what kind of shape he was in,
sure.
You know, everything going on. I said, I don't know what kind of shape he's in. I said, we should find him, and if he's in decent shape, we should try to see about making a deal with him to do a solo record, because I said Kiss fans will really want to hear this.
For sure.
So he said to me, you know, he goes, go ahead and see what you can find out. And we actually tracked him down through Eddie Kramer, the producer. Eddie mixed the Anthrax album Among the Living and had just started to kind of do some work for the Megaforce family. And then Eddie had a line to Ace and said he was going to start doing some demos with him. And we said, well, of course, we want to hear those demos. And we did, and then we went and, you know, we said, asked Eddie how he was doing, you know, health-wise, and he seemed to be okay at that time. Not great, but okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went and we met Ace. I'll never forget. We had a lunch in New York. I forget where it was. I remember Ace ordered a tuna sandwich. You know, with stupid, weird details. But and we sat there, and, you know, I had to play it very cool because there was a side of me that was, you know,
freaking out. No. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I'm a major Kiss fan, and I'm sitting here having lunch with Ace, but I had to very
much
it's
a business lunch.
Be professional, and this is, you know, this is a guy we're trying to sign. And Johnny Z was not a Kiss fan.
Right.
Never a Kiss fan. He was never into it. He didn't really know or understand anything about Kiss. So he really leaned on me throughout the whole process, and I was really the guy pushing him, saying, we got to do this. So he let me take the lead on it, and we ended up obviously signing him. That's what started my relationship with Ace, which I'm happy to say to this day we're still close friends, and I talk to him, you know, almost, you know, at least a couple times a month, if not more. And you know, it came to my wedding 10 years ago. I mean, we've shared some great moments. I mean, I've seen the ups and downs, and I'm extremely, of all the years I've known him, which is over 25, I'm extremely proud of who he is the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I've seen everything in my time and with him, and he is a changed man for the better, and I'm really, really happy that he's been able to finally have the light go off in his life and and be the, you know, be sober and healthy the way he is now. So
I've been told I got 9 lives, or maybe even 10. Now I changed my ways, my soul's restored, I'm better now than then. We're just a little below, a little lower.
I you know, whatever he does musically, how active he is, I really, as a fan, that's, you know, of course I'd love to see it, but for me it's mostly happy. If he doesn't do anything musically again, which I'm not saying he's not, I'm just saying however active
right.
he is, it's up to him. I'm just happy on a personal level that he's healthy and doing well.
Sure, and it's great to see
him. As far as the records we made back then, the first album was real good. The second album was a debacle.
Yeah.
And the third album was really good, but I think, you know, very overlooked because Second Sighting was such a debacle.
Well, I always
people
Trouble
ask me
Walking
why Second
was
Sighting was a debacle, and it's just simply because Ace was really in bad time, bad health, not sober. Couldn't even get him to come into the studio. Todd Howarth had to basically take over the record. Ace is barely on the record.
Yeah,
the songs are not good. The cover is awful.
Yeah,
because we just needed to rush something out because he was about to go on tour with Iron Maiden, and all the label wanted was an album. They didn't care if it was good, bad, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So they slapped a picture that they licensed from NASA on the cover. And you know, we got when Ace didn't show up, they just continued the record with Todd doing everything and pumped it out, and it just was not, you know, outside of the one or two songs, it was just not a good record.
Yeah, yeah. In Kiss fan circles, we've always referred to it as the unofficial Todd Howard solo album. So
yeah, more or less. And listen, Todd's a talented guy, and
oh, sure.
Todd bailed us out because Todd was, you know, again, somebody needed to step up and write the songs and do that. And I mean, yeah, very much was that. I mean, Ace certainly plays on a good part of it, and he you know, he has half the tracks or whatever, but most of the songs are not good, and performances were not great. And I just, you know, if you read Ace's book, he really glosses over a huge part of that period.
Yeah.
Right.
And I could do a whole book just on that period myself because I lived it and I was never impaired because I've never had issues like that. But, mm-hmm. you know, when I talked to Ace about it, he did that because quite honestly, he just doesn't remember it.
Yeah.
He alludes to the fact in his book that that was a bad, bad time for him. And it was. And the one story in his book about the fish sandwich story.
Yeah, I read that. That was funny.
Pointed out, I wrote that for him in his book. His book was almost put to bed, and he said, I talked to him. He said, "Hey, you got any stories for me?" And I said, "I got one. How many do you want?" I just said, "I don't know. I could tell you which one do you want. You want fish sandwich?" He looked at me. He goes, "What are you talking about?" And I told him. He goes, "Oh my God, yeah, you got to write that for me." So that's how that ended up getting
wow.
in the book. But trust me, there's a million.
I'm
yeah,
sure.
I can imagine. Well, on behalf of all the Ace Frehley fans, you know, I'd like to say thank you for, you know, originally reaching out to him in a time where who knew, you know, what would have happened. You know, it was just, you know, like at the time it was before internet. Like you said, nobody seen him without his makeup on. Nobody knew what he was up to other than the, you know, something out of a newspaper once in a while saying he was getting in some trouble. But then all of a sudden, you know, Frehley's comic came out. And for me as a kid, you know, that was huge, you know, because I was such a big Ace Frehley fan. And it was amazing that this guy was coming out with new music. So thank you.
Well, listen, thank you. I mean, I for me, it was just, again, a labor of love. It was more selfish than anything. I mean,
I bet.
I wanted the world to obviously, you know, hear from Ace again. And he was always one of my favorite members of the band. It was a big thrill as a kid to be working with him, to go to England with him, to, you know, to work on some of this stuff. And, you know, it was great. I mean, it was great. I mean, it's funny. We're talking about us mentioning Second Sighting before. I actually have an executive producer credit on that album.
Oh yeah.
And it's just, it's funny because the album is awful. And people say like, well, you have a producer credit on it. I was like, I know, but I can still tell you it was awful because, you know, my producing at that point was to just get the record out.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, all they cared about was the record coming out. I mean, Atlantic just needed a record. They didn't care who was on it or how it appeared. So that's, you know, I worked more on that album than anything else, but it was not still, I can still look at it and say it wasn't a great album.
Right.
Listen to the Decibel Geek podcast on your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and WebOS phones with Stitcher. Stitcher's smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
What we do is we need that extra push over the cliff. You know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly.
The only podcast that goes to 11.
One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast.
You listed as one of your most proud accomplishments was this New York Steel show that you put together after 9/11. Describe for me basically, because I'm assuming you were in that area when when 9/11 happened. Describe to me your perspective on when that happened, what you were going through, and how quickly this show came together that you did with Ace Overkill, Twisted Sister, and Anthrax, and Sebastian Bach.
I was actually on vacation in Las Vegas.
Oh, you were? Okay.
On 9/11, when 9/11 happened. I was actually scheduled to fly back from Las Vegas that day.
Oh,
wow.
I was there on vacation with some friends, and so I was not here, you know, and it made it even harder because I was so far away, and, you know, obviously my family and everybody was back here trying to sit to figure out what the heck was going on, and it was obviously a scary, confusing time for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So it was tough. I mean, I was stuck in Vegas for about 7 days more. I was supposed to come back that day, but then when all the air was grounded and everything, I had no choice but to just sit it out there until they started flying again. So that's, you know, that's where I physically was on 9/11. But when I did finally get back home, you know, I was doing this radio show, again, the same radio show we talked about at the top of this conversation that I started back in the early 80s is still the same show I do now. Every Friday on Q104 out of New York. And it's also on the web, and it's also through affiliates and all that. But it's everything I've done, it's just an extension of that show. And I got back here, and finally, you know, after the station resumed normal programming, I started getting back into music. And then I started to see things that really bothered me, because there was a list of songs that came out that it was said these songs are, you know, shouldn't be played right now because times are too sensitive. And
I was working on radio at that time, too. I remember that list.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really absurd to me. I found that really offensive that someone would tell people, you know, music should be an escape for no matter what kind of music you're into. And, you know, who is anybody to tell you that this should and shouldn't be played? You know, you should play what's going to make you feel better.
Sure,
right.
A lot of the EMS workers and the cops and the firefighters all listened to my show. They were among the first people who listened to my show when it finally went on in New York City, which was back in 94. And they were huge fans of this music and my show. They worked off hours. They worked at night when my show was on. I mean, they were, you know, some of them had become friends, and I was like, you know, I'm going to play this stuff. I don't care what anybody says. So
yeah.
I did, and I stayed true to what I do. And then, you know, there were a lot of benefits being announced. The big one at Madison Square Garden in New York, I think Billy Joel was behind. And listen, I mean, all credit to those guys. That's huge stuff, and for a good cause and all that. But I was, again, I mean, I've always fought against the stereotypes of this music and the perceptions of this music. So I said, well, I'm going to put, you know, there needs to be something for the rockers. There needs to be something for these EMT guys that don't want to hear Billy Joel play Piano Man, that want to hear some rock.
Right.
Absolutely.
So I started putting the gears in motion as to what I could possibly do along those lines. And it was hard because nobody was coming to New York for anything recreational at that point, unless it was major.
Mm-hmm.
People were still afraid to hang out in New York for a long time. You know, the World Trade Center is still, you know, burning. I mean, so it was rough, and promoters were skeptical about it. And I said, well, you know, I kept pushing, and there was a promotion arm, local promoter, Metropolitan Entertainment at the time, who had this relatively new venue called Hammerstein Ballroom, which is still there today and is now very established. But back then it was a new venue. And a few months before 9/11, they'd shown it to me and said, hey, if you ever get any ideas and want to do something, let us know. So here was the idea. So I took it to them, and they were really a big key in making it happen. They were great. They gave me the venue for the charity, and we laid it all out. And then I got to put together some bands, and I wanted it to all be New York bands, not only because it was a 9/11 benefit, but I also wanted it to, I didn't want to have to start flying people in and putting them up.
Right.
Because then that destroys your budget and your ability to make money for the charity.
Mm-hmm.
It's always astonishing to me when I hear about charities and I'm heard that people are paid a ton of money and they're flown in and put up first class and this and that. And it doesn't really seem like, how can it truly be charitable then?
Because, right. Because you're still,
you know,
getting paid for it. You know,
yeah,
a charitable,
I mean, listen,
act is something
do
you don't get in return.
Yeah, I understand that you do a charity event and you don't want to come out of pocket, and you're donating your time and your services. That's one thing. But when you do a charity event and you start having agents and stuff negotiate huge fees for you, then you're not really, I don't really see it as being charity. You're really doing a gig, which is fine, but it's just, it destroys the ability to raise money for the charity. So I tried to avoid all that by putting that lineup together. So I just went to people that were longtime friends, like Overkill, Anthrax. I talked to Skid Row at that point about trying to do a reunion.
Oh, that would have been something.
And I thought that would have been a really, you know, they were New Jersey based, obviously. They were all friends growing up.
Yeah.
That would be a really great opportunity to do it. That didn't work out. So I went to, Sebastian was doing Rocky Horror, I think, on Broadway at the time.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I called him and I said, listen, you know, I'm doing this thing. And it was just very much like that. And then I called the Anthrax guys, and basically everybody was like, we're in, you know, it's New York. We're all New York. Let's go do it.
Yeah.
So I submitted this bill of Anthrax, Overkill, Sebastian, and Ace. I spoke to Ace, and Ace was like, yeah, I'd love to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that as the four. And I took it to the promoter, to Metropolitan, and they said, listen, In a normal world, this would be a great bill, but we're not in a normal world right now.
Right.
And we need, these are all bands that are active and play and are around and accessible. We need something that is going to push this over the top.
Mm-hmm.
So they should go back to the drawing board, find a big hook at the top of the bill. What can you do? So put my thinking cap back on, and, you know, for 13 years, Twisted Sister were hating each other and sniping at each other, and all the members of that band would come into my radio show to promote solo projects.
Right.
Right.
And I called J.J. French, and I said, listen, your New York band, Mark Mendoza works, I think, for the state troopers on Long Island. I mean, those guys are very, very much do great things for the troops and stuff. And over the years, I said, listen, in New York band, if you're ever going to bury the hatchet here and you're looking for a reason to really bury it and, you know, go play some music again, this is it. And I laid it out to him. He said, well, it won't be easy, but let me go back and see if I could pull the guys together and tell them. Mm-hmm. So a few days later, I got a call from JJ, and he said, we're going to do it.
Nice.
So then they had to go through their process, which was not easy. And they just put out a DVD of their performance, and a documentary is on it about what they personally went through to get together for New York Steel.
Mm-hmm.
But they went through a lot of healing and getting it together to do what at the time was going to be a one-time performance and the first show they did in 13 years. And since, they've played consistently ever since for 10 years now.
Right.
Not on a real big touring level, but they play, you know, they play probably 20, 30 shows a year around the world.
Right.
So that was really the catalyst that relaunched that band and has them still going today, and that's kind of where it all started. So it was a great event. We raised about $200,000 after all the expenses were backed out. We gave it to the police and firefighters, widows and orphans fund, and a good friend of mine, baseball star Mike Piazza, hosted it with me, and he was playing for the Mets at the time. So it had a great New York flavor. I remember VH1 did a special from it. This is, of course, before I was working for them. So it was really, like I said, for me to have been able to put something like that together on the strength of really 1 3-hour-a-week radio show,
mm-hmm.
and have the artist community and the fans respond like they did, and to be able to put a positive face on this music.
Right.
Something I'm really proud of.
Right.
And that is awesome, Eddie. That's really awesome. You know, and you're right, because people look at heavy metal as, you know, oh, that's a long hair, you know, dirty, bad people listen to metal, you know, lowest common denominator. But then, you know, you got guys like you, you know, putting stuff like this together. You know, it's the same, you know, you're like our champion almost. You champion our cause, just like we try to do here on the Decibel Geek podcast. You know, do some intelligent talk and, you know, talk about hard rock and metal and introduce new bands and try to keep it going, you know. But it started with you. You know, you're the one that really, you know, because of your love of the music, you know, and that's what makes it great, is because it came from a really pure place, and how you've been able to parlay that into this long career of being able to do all these amazing things. And, you know, it never strays away from, you know, hey, it's not about me, Eddie Trunk. It's about hard rock and heavy metal music. And, you know, we thank you for it. You know, it's been amazing, all the things you've done.
Well, listen, I mean, I really appreciate you saying that. I don't, unless I'm doing an interview like this where we're talking about that stuff in those days, it really doesn't really hit me about the things I've done, because I'm always just moving forward. I'm always thinking,
right,
of, okay, what's next week? What's next month? What's next year? You know, what can I do? And I'm always thinking about the one real thing that I look at as a good quality is I'm not complacent at all. I mean, I could have been like, you know, fine about, oh, I'm doing a radio show, I'm good with that. But I'm always looking for ways to build either of the radio shows, always looking for ways to do more. I mean, you know, people say now you got two radio shows, an FM show, a satellite show, you've got a book, you've got a TV show, you know, you got to be pretty set. I'm like, no. I mean, I honestly, I don't say that selfishly, but I don't think I've even scratched the surface. You know,
right,
on the TV side, I, I wish we were on every day of the week. I'd love to do Monday to Friday live. I'd
That'd be awesome.
You know, I'd love to be the David Letterman of rock music. I mean, I've got more goals. I mean, I'd love the radio show to be on better hours, more stations, more days. I mean, it's all, you know, it's all what you make of it. And I've been told no to everything I've ever tried to do. From the very first day as a kid coming out of high school that I wanted to do radio, I was told, well, you're not really set up for it. You really don't have the voice for it. You can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I love being told no. to this day, you know, I don't have an agent. I don't have a manager. I don't have, you know, I have no, you know, I have people that help me from time to time when I need it. But, I mean, I don't, it's not like that. I mean, I just get out there, get my hands dirty, do my best to find opportunities and hope things, you know, come my way and good things come my way. But it's all driven just not only building what I'm doing, but in turn, I look at it as a way to build access and exposure for these bands. And when I hear people like you say that, it means a lot. I mean, I've been in this game now coming up on 30 years, but I don't feel like I've even, you know, I feel like I've got so much more I want to do and hope to be able to do. But it's nice when, you know, people, I run into people or meet people or do interviews with people that really appreciate it, because I never really take a beat to say, yeah, you know, I obviously big things, like, you know, when I got on TV, when I got the New York Steel show going, when I got my radio show going, you know, those are big kind of landmark things, getting the record company jobs. But,
yeah,
you know, when you got fans and then you get artists, like, you know, 4 years ago, Judas Priest plays a private show for me to say thank you for supporting them.
Yeah.
The late Ronnie James Dio, you know, all the things he's been on the record that he said about me is just, it's really staggering to me, because at the end of the day, I just think of myself as a fan.
You know, I was one of the early people that got VH1 Classic, and I remember watching you on the Hanging With show, and it was just unbelievable. And I remember telling my wife at the time, I was like, this guy has my dream job. I was just like, because I was like, can you imagine going to work every day? Oh, I'm going to interview so-and-so today. And then this other hero of mine, I mean, that must have been surreal, you know, not, you know, going in each day, you know, getting an interview with all these legendary people that you probably grew up listening to.
Well, it was. The good thing about it is, even at that point, when I first got that gig in 02, 03 with VH1 Classic doing that show, even at that point, I had a good 10 years of radio under my belt. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the rock guys I knew, or they knew me because they had come and done my show.
Right.
The challenge was that was all styles of music. That was everything from Aretha Franklin to alternative acts to Carly Simon. I'd interviewed her in Martha's Vineyard at her house.
Wow.
John Mellencamp, I mean, it was the gamut of styles of music, and I had to do all of it. And even though, you know, I wasn't a fan.
Do you get excited about an interview with, like, Carly Simon or somebody? I mean, knowing that you're a metal fan through and through, I mean, is it still fun to interview somebody that you're
so much into? I really did enjoy it, and I'll tell you, I miss it. I really miss that, because those are artists I don't know. And it's fun to learn with the audience, and those are the things that I have to really kind of do my homework on.
Right.
And those are the things I'm really proud of having been able to done as well, because, you know, you could put me in front of any rock act, and I could just do it in 2 seconds without even looking at a piece of paper or prep or anything, because it's what I do. I don't. When I do that metal show, I mean, I can tell you, it's kind of a running joke on the set, because the producers make these big binders with all these prep materials and bios, and, you know, we've just done 10 seasons, and I've never opened one of them.
Yeah,
and
I bet.
They laugh, because they're like, you really, you know, they need to do it for other people on the set and everything, but it's like, you know, I'm like, guys, save the paper. And it's not trying to be arrogant, it's just I've lived it. I don't, for these guys, I don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
So when I would sit down with Carly Simon at her house in Martha's Vineyard, yeah, I know you're so vain and whatever, but you know what? I'm going to brush up a little bit. So you come at it from a different perspective, and the one thing I've always been good at is talking, and I can talk circles around anybody, as I'm sure you can figure out.
We're enjoying it.
Listen, man, it's like, you know, let's go do it. I mean, I can talk. even if I don't have the prep material, I can get anybody talking. So let's go do it. It's one of the things I'm probably, you know, it's probably my biggest strength. So I really enjoyed doing that stuff. And you know, I'll tell you something a lot of people don't know. I did not want that metal show to be purely a metal show.
Really?
I fought the name of the show.
Really?
And, yeah, because I wanted the show, I certainly wanted it to be rock and metal, but I wanted it to be, I was worried about having the word metal in the title painting us into a corner.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I can see that.
And it has to some degree, but what's happened is, you know, because we've been on now for so long, people, I think, have realized that regardless of the name of the show, we're going to be a rock show and a metal show.
Right.
And I say it at the top of every episode.
Yes, you do.
Of rock and metal. Because VH1 loved the name. It was their idea to call it that metal show. And listen, I mean, it had to get on the air, so whatever they needed to call it.
Sure.
Right.
I just want to do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I want, you know, we just last season had Paul Rogers on. I mean, that's not a guy that screams metal, but hugely influential. So we're going to, you know, somebody pointed out to me the other day, VH1 stands for Video Hits 1.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's not a lot of video on there.
No.
You know, not a lot of video hits on there anymore. ESPN is, you know, what does that stand for? So,
MTV,
you know,
even. Where's the music?
We're going to just kind of evolve as best we can. And, you know, there'd be some people that might squeak about it, the metal purists. But it has to be, you know, more than just, you know, one thing. I'm not saying we're having Carly Simon on tonight.
Right.
I'm just saying.
But you could interview her if you did.
What's that?
But you could easily interview her if you did.
Sure, I'd ask her if she ever heard Faster Pussycat.
I was gonna ask you if you asked her that. That's a pretty good version of that.
Because it wasn't right at the time, but if she came on TMS, I would.
Or you could get her to come on and do a duet with Faster Pussycat. You never know.
There you go.
That'd be cool.
Well, and you've got
that's also the hugest difference. If you see old stuff I did on VH1 Classic versus that metal show, the hugest difference I can tell, beyond this way it's shot and who I'm talking to, is me and how I'm doing the interview. And what I mean by that is that was a completely different structure doing that hanging with show. I was completely dictated to by a producer as to how I was to act, what I was to say, how I was to say it, how it was to be presented.
Wow.
So it was not, some of it is me, and some of it I ad-lib and go off the grid a little bit, but it was a hell of a lot more structured than what you see now on TMS, which truly is me and is completely the opposite, where there is no structure as far as you can only ask this or you can't ask that or, you know, I want to know what you're going to talk about. It is just, you know,
and it shows, I think.
Go do what you do.
Right.
It definitely shows when you watch it, too, to tell you guys, you know, you're having a good time doing what you're doing, and that conveys to the audience. I mean, I think it makes the audience enjoy it that much more.
Well, we're friends. I mean, Don and Jim are friends. I brought them into the show. They were listeners of my radio show. They're both stand-up comics. We are friends. We talk about music all the time. We used to go to shows all the time together. And when this, you know, it came around that they wanted to inject some, you know, different life into this show and create some ball busting and have some, you know, have some different dynamic, I said, well, I've got just the guys. So they came in and brought them up to the network, introduced them to the network, and we shot the pilot, and, you know, here we are. So what you see is very real and very natural. There's nothing calculated about it at all. The arguments we get into are arguments we get into, and you know, it's never malicious. We still,
right,
we're friends, so we can break each other's chops.
Well, and I like the looseness of the show and the looseness of the talk on the show, but I did see the Axl Rose interview you did this past year, and you know, and you're the only one that really seems to be able to get him to do interviews. I gotta wonder though, was there like a no ask list on certain questions with him on that episode? Because it just, I wonder if there was just like restrictions that you were put under.
Well, here's the deal, and it's come up a couple of times. There's a few things with that.
Mm-hmm.
We were, first of all, I think it's well documented now, and I just wrote an article in Classic Rock about it. You know, we were, it's not an excuse, but we were literally up for nearly 24 hours.
Right.
That interview. Mm-hmm. I you get an interview that magnitude, I prefer to be a lot sharper and a lot more on my game than that. I was literally sleeping seconds before he walked in.
And you guys just showed up for that too. This wasn't really scheduled ahead of time, right?
It was loosely scheduled. That we were not given a guarantee it was going to happen. It was just, hey, if you're there, and he sees Eddie, or he gets the vibe, maybe we'll get him to come over, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all a big gamble. So we didn't know if he was going to show up, when he was going to show up, and we certainly didn't expect it to be there for nearly 24 hours. But that's not the fault. I have to make that clear. That's not the fault of Axel. Again, he made no commitments about this thing. Mm-hmm. We waited it out and we ended up getting it. So there was that. And the other thing about the whole thing with the Axel interview is that it was very much the reason he did it, and really what it was about was mainly to promote that tour mm-hmm. that he was on and that band. This band that he has now.
Right.
So the only real restriction we were asked about from his team was that we did not go into the old stuff and reunions and, this and that. And, what about a reunion and what about Slash and all that? Because they wanted, number one, they thought it would be disrespectful to the current band.
Sure.
And also defeating to the point of why he was doing it, which is, that was shown at the early stages of what was a run of tour dates in America. And if the guy's trying to sell a tour and sell a new band,
mm-hmm.
and if the entire interview is talking about Appetite, it doesn't really serve a purpose of, what he was trying to do, which is establish this lineup of Guns N' Roses.
I suppose by asking.
I can understand where he was coming from, and we did our best. But, he actually bought up the old days a number of times. So we did the best we could,
mm-hmm.
considering the circumstances. In a perfect world, I'd love to be one-on-one with the guy for 2 hours, rested and ready to go.
Right.
And we could really get into some stuff. But at that point, we were just kind of, getting the best we could out of it.
Right. Okay.
Well, and that was the first interview on TV in, 10 years? So I'd say it was worth it.
If not longer.
Yeah.
And, you've got to be, everybody knows that Axel's an interesting guy and can be a volatile guy. And if I had the same experience with him 5 years ago on the radio show. If you put him in a comfort zone, he'll hang out and he'll get relaxed, talk to you as long as you want him to. But if he senses things going in a direction he doesn't like, then you might have gotten a 2-minute interview there and he would have gotten up and walked out.
Right. Yeah.
So it's a balancing act. It really is. But I can say this for the record now, having interviewed him on radio and TV,
mm-hmm.
Once he gets out there and sits down with you, he's a lot of fun to talk to. He's a regular guy. That's the biggest response I've gotten from that interview is people saying, I've heard from people like, I wish you would ask this, or
let him off the hook on something.
I get all that, and but people have to understand what the circumstances involved, and some of the way we were working and the things we were dealing with there.
Right.
But I can say that once he gets rolling, he's great.
Yeah, and so we've got the new season of That Metal Show coming up. Is it next month that it's starting up?
We start taping it next month.
Oh, and
it'll air, I believe. I think the first one airs the last Saturday of March.
Is there any clues you're going to drop about possible guests?
No. I actually have a call in a couple hours from now to solidify the lineup, so maybe in a few days we'll be able to release it.
Oh, okay, cool.
But we've got about 80% probably booked. A huge part of my involvement in the show beyond what I do on camera is behind the scenes and working with the network on getting guests on the hook, and It's a process. It's pretty time consuming, and sometimes it's easier than other times, but only because the way we work, we do 2 shows a day, so we work for a week and we're done with the whole season.
Mm-hmm.
And if the artists are on tour or something like that, it's hard to get them when we need them. But we've got a great roster this time around. I think the past few seasons have been really strong. We've had some amazing people like Brian Johnson and Lars Ulrich and Tony Iommi. And the only thing I can say is that we're going to continue the evolution of the show and branching out in some different areas in rock and metal. And we're also going to continue to have back guests. I mean, people ask sometimes like, sometimes half of the season are people that have been on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have been. But what's the problem? I mean, any talk show you watch on TV has guests back after three or 6 months.
Absolutely.
You know? These guys' stories change, things develop, and we're an established show now. So, of course, certain artists are going to come back, some sooner than others, depending upon how big they are or what they've got going on. So it will be a mix of returning guests and first-timers. And I'm excited to make the announcement, which I hope to be able to do very soon, because there's one band. We've had a few, just a very few handful of bands that have eluded us for one reason or another. And there's one band that we're finally, a mega band in this genre of music, that we're finally going to get a member of on. So
nice.
That's going to be exciting to a lot of fans of that band.
Well, we look forward to that new season. Just like always, we all love the metal show. You know, between, you know, the TV work, the behind the scenes, the radio shows, the appearances, the tracking down Guns N' Roses, where does a guy like Eddie Trunk find time to write a book?
In the gaps between all those things, the book was something that was a lot of fun, but a lot more work than I ever thought it was going to be, and very time consuming. And I enjoyed the process, and I'm really happy with the end result. It's done extremely well, and people are still just discovering it and buying it, and the feedback has been amazingly positive to it, which I'm really happy about. But yeah, it was a lot of work. My publisher, though, did a great job in assisting in that work and doing the layout and dealing with the photos and the graphics and the look of it and all that. I mean, that was all on them. They did an amazing job in that regard. But as far as getting those words out on paper and in print, it was a process, and something I did some of on my own and a lot of with a woman named Andrea Bussell, who's credited on the book as well, who really was, when my hands were falling off at the typewriter, the computer, of course, you know, I'm not a good typer. I'm not a trained typist.
Yeah.
So I really started to just, you know, burn out on it. And I said, listen, I need somebody that I can actually talk to about this and who could do this part of it and help me shape this stuff. So that's where she came in, and she was really invaluable in that. So it ended up being very, very, very long phone conversations for a while with her. Going through the text, so it's been great, and they are talking to me about, you know, they've asked me about doing a second one, and a lot of fans have asked me about doing a second one,
I bet.
Sequel, and I certainly want to, and maybe we'll even start on it sometime this year, but I need to make sure that before I do that, mentally I'm ready to tackle it, and that I have the time to do it. And there was times doing the book that I had to stop for a few weeks because I have to go shoot the TV show, and I really just, my focus needs to be where it is, so I couldn't be worried about doing chapters when I was there. So
right,
it just, I need to clear out a good stretch of, you know, okay, here's a month, let's get right to it, and I can pretty much knock it out.
Awesome.
Well, the new book it's called Essential Hard Rock and Heavy Metal, Eddie Trunk's book. If, you know, fans of the Decibel Geek podcast, I know are all fans of hard rock and heavy metal, that's a must-have for your library. Put it on your bookshelf. Let everybody know.
People have asked about getting signed copies of the book, and you can buy the book anywhere you can buy books, bookstores, Amazon, whatever. But if you want signed copies that I personalize and ship right out, there's a tab right on the homepage of my website. You can mail away, and I'll send one out to you signed. So there's that. And the last thing, if I could just mention, is the website's eddietrunk.com, and my Twitter is @EddieTrunk. And people are always asking me about how do they get into tapings of that metal show.
Mm-hmm.
How do they keep up with what's going on with the show? Who's coming on? Who the guests are? You know, getting to be in the studio audience, all that. Biggest thing I can tell you is if you follow on Twitter, you'll get the information immediately, because as soon as I get it, I pump it out.
Awesome.
And this man does tweet, and he tweets often.
Yeah, listen, man, I got into Twitter. I was never a big Facebook guy. I have a Facebook. It kind of mirrors whatever I put up on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
The Twitter mirrors over there. I am not computer savvy at all. I'm terrible with it. I'm terrible with, you know, I so and then there's this social media overload where it's like, you know, you log into Facebook and there's, oh my God, there's 20,000 people that are trying to ask you a question or want to talk to you about something. It becomes daunting, and you realize you just spent your whole day in front of a computer answering emails and Facebooks and tweets and that. And, you know, you didn't really do anything that you had to do. So the one thing I've learned, the one thing I really love about Twitter is that I it's a real connect with the audience. It's real easy. It's real instant.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I'll take as much time as I can in clusters throughout the day if I answering some questions where I can, and, you know, just try to, you know, I use it, you know, people love some of the personal stuff. Sometimes people just want the music stuff. Sometimes people don't, you know, don't care about the sports stuff that I'm into. But, you know, my thing about it is, listen, I mean, it's a personal thing. You're going to get a little of everything, and it's me. It's what's going on with me. So if you follow, that's what you're getting. And I also put a fair dose of, you know, content and things that I'm hearing about tours and, you know, real music news that I hear along the wire that I can share also. So it's a mix of a lot of things, and it's become a fun kind of little community that I built there.
Awesome. And, well, I want to thank you again for coming on, and we'll be sure to put links up in the show notes on our website for all your for your Twitter and for the links to get to the book.
And the many, many endeavors.
Many endeavors. And then we'll be looking for that metal show coming up soon.
I appreciate it, guys. Thank you for having me on, and best of luck to what you guys are doing, and I appreciate the support.
Broadcasting live from Lemmy's Mole, you're listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast.
Eddie Trunk's talked to everybody in hard rock and heavy metal at some point, and as we found out, you know, some other interesting interviews that he's had to do that's really kind of out of his genre of interest. But, you know, the guy's a professional, and it's cool, man. It was very awesome talking to Eddie Trunk. One thing I forgot to ask him was, how did it feel to be immortalized in an Overkill song? You ever heard the song Old School?
No, I haven't.
It's, you ought to check that out. That's a really cool song by Overkill. It's kind of a punk rock tune, but they pay homage to Johnny Z and Eddie Trunk, and it's kind of like the history of Overkill wrapped up into a song. It's really awesome.
Good old Bobby Blitz.
Yeah, called Old School. Yeah, check that song out.
Check that out. But for all things Eddie Trunk, if you want to pick up his new book and find out what he's going up to, what he's up to, all the stuff for That Metal Show, well, obviously, That Metal Show, VH1Classic.com. Also, and for anything Eddie Trunk is EddieTrunk.com.
Awesome website. Highly recommend you check that out.
Lots of good stuff there. And, of course, check out our links, www.dbgeekshow.blogspot.com. Check out our Facebook at facebook.com/decibelgeek, Twitter at decibelgeekpod, and all that good stuff. We'll have some YouTube videos up for you soon on that page. So hang in there, folks. Aaron, any last words?
I think, you know, the last few weeks we've been alluding to doing this video or this interview and promised that there were some big things in the works, and I like to feel like we delivered the goods. So once again, you know, we're here. We're the Decibel Geek Podcast. We're here spreading the love for all our hard rock and heavy metal brothers and sisters, and we're delivering the goods, baby. So stay tuned, because we got even more big stuff coming up, and we promised this was going to be big, and it was. So when I tell you we got more big things in store, you know I'm not lying. We got it under control. Right, Chris?
That'll work.
All right.
See you next week.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com. Code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.